This is the Photography Podcast on photography.ca, episode number 62, an introduction to calibrating your monitor and your printer. Hey there, photo lovers, and welcome to the 62nd Photography Podcast on photography.ca. My name is Marco, and as always, we're coming to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. For today's show, and for the podcast that's going to follow, we're going to cover a really, really, really important topic. We're going to talk about calibrating your monitor, and we're going to talk about calibrating your printer. As photographers, mostly digital photographers these days, at the end of the day, we're looking at our images on our monitor, and at the end of the day, we want to see prints, if we're printing, that match the monitor. And we also want to see good colors, even across the web, if we want to send our pictures somewhere or post on social networking sites, etc. We have to get some accurate color going, and today we're going to talk about it. It's an in-depth topic. We're lucky enough to have an expert, Joe Brady, and I'll introduce him in a second, but it's such an important topic, and I've been wanting to do it for a while, and finally ready to put it out. As always, before introducing this week's topic, I'd like to pay homage to the last topic, which was really, really, really interesting, and we got a lot of good comments where we talked about what makes a photo great. So Stephen K, Jay LaBelle, Kent Wilson, and Susan all posted comments on that last podcast, the number 61, where we talk philosophically and practically about what we think makes a photo great and how we can use that standard to improve our own photography. And really quickly, I'd also like to thank some of our bulletin board members. We have an active forum now, and a lot of people have joined the forum, and some of them because they've listened to this podcast, and it makes me so, so, so happy. There always seems to be a few regular members on the board now, posting information, answering questions, giving critiques, and it really warms me heart. The spirit of learning and sharing is alive on the photography.ca forum, and I do indeed encourage new people to join. Really, really quickly, I want to thank Tomorrow's Treasures, Matt Aussie, Travis, Tired Iron, Kylie, Akadi Libra, Jelling, Ben H, Cat, Mindforge, Iggy, Michael AW, Barefoot, Badness, Raven, Lovin, Dwayne Oaks, EJC, and Ishak, and so many others whose names just escaped me. But thanks so much for all your input. We really have developed a community here. I so encourage lurkers to join, you know. A lot of people just hang out on a forum looking without really joining, but we are a friendly bunch, man. We're really friendly. In fact, I pride ourselves on our friendliness. A lot of forums are snitty, and it's not to say we never have a snitty moment, but all in all, holy moly, we're a friendly bunch of people, and we're all here to learn and share. So if you're lurking, join. You got nothing to lose. Hang out for a day or two. If you don't like it, feel free to leave, but we're going to try and make you feel welcome. In terms of new assignments on the forum, those are getting also quite a lot of attention. And assignments for this month are wind, whereby we just try and take a creative picture of wind and show it around. And we also have the photographing words assignment, whereby we photograph individual objects that look like letters in order to make words. And again, we chose wind this month. So wind is the topic for two assignments this month. Other threads on our bulletin board are also getting tons of action. We have a 25-page thread on Guess What This Is, where members take macro pictures or they try and disguise pictures and other members have to guess what they are. And once a particular member has to guess what it is, it's their turn to put up an image for other people to guess. So, you know, there's a lot of fun things going on. I encourage you to join. If you have any ideas and or suggestions, just feel free to give me a shout at any time. photography.ca@gmail.com. Join the forum and private message me. I'm easy to find, and whatever way you find me or the community, it's all welcome. So, enjoy. Okay, so let's get right into the topic at hand. An introduction to calibrating your monitor and your printer. As fine art photographers, it's so important. You know, a lot of us are printing by ourselves these days, and we have these amazing printers, but we can't wrap our heads around getting a good image from our printer that matches our monitor, and we're going to try and discuss that over the next two podcasts. Before we do, I'd like to thank Mac Group US. They're a friendly bunch of people that I met in New York a few months back, and they were kind enough to loan me two higher-end monitor profiling systems, and you can also profile your printer with them, and I'm going to talk about that next podcast. But just to let the rabbit out of the hat, it's the i1 system and the Color Monkey system. And both of these will be really useful to fine art photographers, and I'll review them in depth next podcast. Before I review them, though, we're going to have an interview with Joe Brady, again from Mac Group US. So nice, so kind. He's sharing all kinds of good information. And I wanted Joe to do this because there's a lot of concepts that are foreign, even to myself. In this new digital age, it's all about getting accuracy, and it's complex. And Joe knows this stuff backwards. So without further ado, let's get right into the interview with Joe Brady from Mac Group US now. So I'd like to welcome a special guest to our podcast. This is an expert in color. He knows color, and a lot of us have so many questions about color. So this is actually Joe Brady from Mac Group, and welcome to our podcast, Joe.
Good morning. Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much. Actually, I'll just give a bit of a preface in the podcast. After this, I'm going to actually review some equipment, some monitor calibration equipment. But there's a lot of terms and a lot of concepts that people may not be familiar with. So given that Joe knows this stuff backwards, he has been gracious enough to answer some of our questions. So straight up the bat, we have hardware, monitor calibration, but monitors also come with their own calibration algorithms or software involved. What's the difference between the hardware calibration and ones that come with the monitor itself?
The biggest problem with the ones with the monitors is you're relying on your own eyes, which are fooled very easily and are very adaptable. It's a good thing with our own vision, but it's not very good when it comes to calibrating and profile the monitor. I'm sure many of us have tried to play with the Adobe Gamma wizard on both Windows and Mac, where you get the little slider and you're supposed to squint and drag the slider back and forth until the screen meshes. And you are very affected by the time of day, how tired you are, what you've even had to eat or drink. You really just can't do it because your eyes are so adaptable to color. Hardware calibration takes that out of the equation, and it's actually measuring the color data that's showing up on the screen without any influence from you.
Okay, so you've kind of sort of answered my next question. Is the calibration necessary and why? And again, it's because, again, our eyes cannot really be trusted.
No, they can't. They're very adaptable, and it's a good thing for us. We have great tonal range and great adaptability to color, but we're also easily influenced by surrounding colors and the environment.
If we do use a hardware device to calibrate our monitors, how often do we need to calibrate those monitors?
It depends somewhat on the monitor. As a monitor ages, they drift a lot more, and there's one thing there's just no way of escaping. You get what you pay for with monitors. There's a reason that professional monitors are much more expensive. They're much more stable. The color doesn't change over time as much. They're consistent left to right, up and down, and edge to edge. But you do pay a premium for that. A cheap monitor is going to drift. Just as they heat up through the course of the day, they typically get brighter. So a monitor should be calibrated at least once a week. And if I was working on anything less than a professional monitor, something like a high-end Azo, I would calibrate and profile my monitor just before doing a big print job so I could do final edits.
Excellent to know. And in terms of just some quick tips about calibration, the ambient light in the room does play a big part in this, does it not?
Actually, it does not.
Oh, it does not. Okay.
It does not take a bit. No, it does not. It has an effect on your eyes, certainly on the viewing. If your room is overly bright, you're going to have to turn your monitor up a little brighter to compensate for that. When you do that, you do sacrifice some highlight detail, and you can make your shadows unnaturally light. But the calibrator itself doesn't care. It's flush up against the screen, so the ambient light is not affecting it during the calibration process. What you are affected by the ambient light, not the monitor or the calibration system.
I see. So in that respect, is there a best practice with regard to our own eyes? Is like a dimmer ambient light better than bright light, let's say?
Dimmer is definitely better. If you're in a room that doesn't have windows and you have the ability to turn the lights down, that is the best. Barring that, having a hood around your monitor that would just cut down an ambient light is a great help. If you've ever walked into an advertising agency into their editing rooms, you'll typically see it's practically candlelight bright in there. And their monitors had their luminance set very low, because at a lower luminance, the monitors have the greatest tonal range.
Which, again, gets the most information into your eyes and then into the print at the end of the day, I guess.
Exactly. It's a better match because you have better distinguishing characteristics between the dark shadow details and your highlight details.
Okay. Another thing that's really confusing to some of our visitors is, why do images simply look different on the web versus in print when they're spit out of a home printer or a lab printer?
Well, completely different ways of looking at images. On the web, you've got a lot of limitations. You're dealing with 8-bit color. You've got 216 web-safe colors that are RGB backlit in an sRGB color space. And when you're going out to print, you're dealing with CMYK inks printed on paper, and which that is then affected by what is the color temperature of the light that you were viewing that print under, because you're looking at reflected light, and if the light is anything different than a true daylight, office lights or tungsten lights, you're going to get a different result.
Let's talk just really quickly about the RGB color space and the sRGB color space. If someone is outputting an image specifically for the web, what color space should they be working in, and why?
If you're going out to the web is only working in sRGB. Okay. So going on an Adobe RGB monitor isn't going to gain you anything. The whole beauty of an Adobe RGB monitor is if you're going out to CMYK printing, including an inkjet. That said, if you're a wedding portrait photographer that's going out to a lab, the vast majority of lab machinery works in the sRGB space. Unless you have a specific Adobe RGB monitor, again, like an Azo or a high-end LaCie or NEC or Samsung, all your monitors are sRGB anyway.
Okay. Do you have recommendations, let's say, for people that may not have those monitors? And I suspect that's a large amount of even photographers. Often their monitor may be the weakest link in their chain, so to speak. If they're not using one of these monitors, what do you recommend in that case?
Well, that is usually the case. The vast majority of people do not have a professional Adobe RGB monitor, and it is, in fact, the weak link in the whole color workflow chain. You have to realize that your monitor is kind of your window to your entire world. And every editing decision you make is going to be based on what you see on that monitor. And if your monitor is not correct, then any editing decision you make is going to be based on a false starting point. The problem with a cheap monitor, and actually with most kind of general purpose monitors, is that's exactly what they are. They're general purpose. They're designed to watch DVDs and to cruise the web and to play games. And oh, occasionally, maybe you'll want to edit a photo. Because of that, they are overly bright, they're overly contrasty, and they're overly blue. And sometimes, even after doing a hardware calibration and profiling, some of those characteristics remain. They're kind of built into the monitor, and you just can't get rid of them.
When we profile these monitors, how often do the profile itself change? Is the profile itself always stable?
The profile does not move. The profile is basically a set of corrections. It's a characterization of how the monitor displays a certain color when it's asked to do so. For example, you tell your monitor, I need 100% red, and the video card tells it that. Invariably, what happens because of discrepancies in the monitor, that isn't exactly what shows up. And what the measurement devices do is read what color actually shows up when it's asked to produce a certain color. Let's say it's asked to do 100% red, and the measurement device sees, well, it's got 100% red, but it's also got, oh, 5 points of blue in it. A profile is a long list, in essence, of here's what I asked for, here's what I got. Create a set of corrections for that going forward. So that next time you're in, say, Photoshop, and Photoshop says, give me 100% red on this part of the screen, that command goes through the video card and through the profile on the way to the monitor, and the profile tells it, remember, if you really want 100% red on the screen, you're going to have to take out those points of blue to actually get 100% red on the screen. That's in essence what a profile is, and they do not move. They're just a list of numbers.
Okay, and again, in order to get them, we use either the hardware measurements, something external, or we can use the inferior, you know, inbound monitor profile that comes with our monitor.
You could try that, but they really are very bad. You really need hardware to calibrate a monitor. You just cannot accurately do it with your eyes.
And let's just talk about a regular monitor again for 1 second.
Sure.
So for your average monitor that most photographers unfortunately have, they're not seeing all that there is to see in a print. Is that correct?
That's typically the case because everybody's monitor is sRGB unless you have one of the high-end monitors. And one of the limits of sRGB is in any standard inkjet printer, it's capable of printing the CMYK color space, which is smaller than sRGB in some directions but larger in others. Particularly yellows, bright greens, bright blues, and turquoise exist in any standard inkjet printer, but an sRGB monitor cannot display them. And the danger can be if you have an image that contains those colors and you do some kind of global edit on it, say a saturation or curves change, those colors are going to move and you're not going to be able to see them move on the screen because the screen's simply not capable of showing them. That said, if you do hardware calibrate and profile your monitor, you will at least make it do the best job that it's capable of. It will be as close as possible and hopefully you can minimize those effects.
But given that it's only a very average quality monitor that's meant to do many different things, there are different grades of profiling equipment, and some of them that I'm testing and reviewing now are higher-end products. These are in the several $100 or even above $1,000. Does it pay for people to spend that kind of money if they have a cheap monitor?
That's a good question. Would I spend buy the over $1,000 system for a $200 monitor? Probably not.
Right.
Having a basic colorimeter on an inexpensive monitor will make it as good as it can be. However, the units that start to creep above $200, most notably the X-Rite I1 Display 2, control something that the less expensive systems do not, and that's the monitor's luminance or brightness. And that is one of the most critical pieces to get under control first, because as I said before, most monitors are way too bright out of the box. In fact, some monitors you just can't make dim enough to actually be accurate. And if your monitor is set way too bright, what happens is your shadow details look great on the screen because your monitor's so bright. But typically what happens is if you're going out to a lab or printing by yourself, you send out your print and your prints come back way too dark. Now, that's because your monitor was set too bright and you were judging your prints on this overly bright screen. And the very inexpensive systems do not control monitor brightness. First piece, you got to get under control.
Okay, so if they don't control monitor brightness,
and what's going to happen is your prints are going to typically start coming back very dark. And if you're working in a closed system or you know that's how your monitor reacts, you're just going to have to make sure that you're going to have to work very bright in order for your prints to come back correct. Right. You're guessing at that point.
Okay. But it still pays to even use something maybe lower end like the Huey. I mean, I'm not reviewing the Huey, but that still is a far better option than trying to do it yourself with the built-in profile. You're still going to be far more satisfied if you buy this device?
Absolutely. A device okay. like the Huey will at least get your colors as correct as they can be, so you'll at least be seeing the right tones on the screen. Your screen may still be too bright, but it will at least get you much closer to accurate.
But it won't do the luminance and brightness measurements.
It will not. It does not control luminance on a monitor. That's correct.
Okay, good to know. Next question. So after we work on a non-calibrated monitor, then we get some type of calibration system, hardware. We calibrate it. Our image that we worked on pre-calibration, when we open it up, it often is going to look completely wrong. Is that correct? Are we going to have to redo all our images after a calibration? Could you describe that workflow and consequence a little bit?
Sure, that can happen. Since most monitors are way too bright and contrasty, they will actually have the effect of kind of making your images look very sexy with a lot of pop into it, although there will be a lot more contrast in it. After calibration, you might see that your images that looked really poppy and sexy before are duller. They might be a little yellower. They're going to have less contrast in them. The difference is what you're seeing now on the monitor is accurately showing you what's actually in your file. So now you can make adjustments to the image to get it the way you want to go out on print without having the monitor adding its own flavors into it. So yes, you may decide after looking at it on a calibrated monitor, you might want to put a little pop back in and you might want to make some kind of minor color adjustments, but typically it's not too bad a process.
Okay, but still, if you have a file that you want to work with comfortably on your eyes, because even if your monitor is seeing it correctly, and even if the printer is going to spit it out correctly, at the end of the day, if it's all pink on your screen and it's not supposed to have pink, let's say, skin tones, it may be annoying and you may want to fix that file on your screen. Is that correct?
Certainly.
Yeah. And then I also, just before we end, I wanted to get into the actual profiling of the printer with regard to the monitor. That's another big bonus when you're using systems, some of the higher end X-Rite systems or the Color Monkey systems. Can you talk about that match a little bit and why that match is so much more effective with a printer calibrated to your monitor?
Certainly. Just to clear up one point, even though the software says match my printer to my display, the printer and the display aren't talking to each other at all. They don't even know each other's there. It's kind of an analogy as to what actually happens. What you're doing is you're creating a correct profile for your monitor and a profile for your printer. So we've made our monitor correct, and we're going to make our printer correct. So since they're both correct, they now match. Most printer profiles out of the box or factory profiles are just very generic, and there's a lot of variations in print heads and environment that will affect how your printer and your paper combination actually produce a color. So we've got our monitor correct, we see the image on the screen, we know it's accurately showing us the data that's in the file. When you create a printer profile, it's in some ways similar to the monitor profile. You print out a chart that has a whole lot of colors on it that are known values. The device then measures those values, and just like when we did with the monitor, it compares what it was asked for to what it got. And it creates a set of corrections based on what it's read off of those prints. So that the next time you go out to print, and the print, going back to the monitor example, is asked to print 100% red, it knows what corrections need to be made to make that actually happen. So the beauty is what you see on your screen is actually what comes out on your printer the first time.
And that's actually an important factor, and it is different from what either the paper manufacturer or the printer manufacturer is going to give you. Because like you say, sometimes we can download a drivers for our printer, and they already have profiles of papers that are already matched, but those are certainly not going to be as good as the printer actually printing out a test sheet using the existing inks that may have aged, that may have changed somewhat, and then measuring straight off those test patches.
Absolutely, and this is even more critical for third-party papers and fine art papers because they typically respond much differently based on environment and temperature. If you're in a much warmer, more humid space than the lab where the paper profiles were originally created, you're going to get a very different result. Even when a manufacturer creates a paper profile, they're typically going to print it on many different printers and then average it. And the reason they need to do this is because there's a lot of variations in the print heads. You might have two of the same model printer in your office and get different results from them. When you create a custom profile, you are characterizing how that exact printer and paper combination is producing color, so you get exact results every time.
So again, it's just far more accurate, especially if you're doing fine art stuff with the many different papers. As you know, there's so many papers now, and it's exciting. They have different textures, different thicknesses. It's exciting to print on new papers. It almost is like the heyday back to black and white printing when there were a multitude of papers that can give you different effects. But you have to be aware that the inks are going to print wonky on certain papers some of the time. And again, these calibration devices are meant to reduce that wonkiness, I would suggest.
Well, it's true, and I love printing on some of the fine art papers, but we've all seen the fine art papers and the combination of the inks that they put out can get very expensive. I don't know anyone out there that wants to have to print five times to finally get the correct print. The money really has to add up when you do that. By having a custom profile, you get to print once and be done. So it saves you a lot of time and money.
Yeah, and I can just say from personal experience, before I started my own calibration, I mean, trying to calibrate the printer in the dialog boxes is just a friggin' nightmare, and it takes forever, and it is a humongous waste of ink.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so before we actually end, can you just get into a little bit, and I know we've already talked about it, but just get into a little bit of what is an ICC profile, define it a little bit, and just put it into a final context.
All right, kind of in layman's terms, an ICC profile, it's a characterization of how any device produces color when asked to do so. So if my monitor works in a certain space, let's say it's an sRGB device, it's using RGB backlit pixels to produce its color, That needs to be translated when it's going to go to some other device. So if I want to take that image that's on my screen and I want to print it out, the profiles allow, kind of think of it as a translation from one device space to another so that the colors will match as closely as possible. You got to understand that a printer and a monitor will never exactly match because they're producing color in different ways. You've got a backlit RGB screen on your monitor. You've got CMYK inks that are using the reflected light to produce their color. So there's occasionally going to be colors that one device can produce that another device just cannot match. But what we're after is accurate and consistent. We'll understand that a glowing neon color on our screen is not going to show up on a matte fine art paper. It's just going to lose that that super brightness because the paper just cannot produce it. But with that in mind, having a profile allows us to accurately and consistently translate color from one device to another as best as we can.
So that neon at least will appear the same color neon and an intensity of neon, albeit without the glow that we would see on our screens.
Correct. We've all seen what matte, you know, the super saturated colors on matte paper just lose some of their saturation because a matte paper takes the gleam out of it.
Right. And like you mentioned also, it's just a function of the difference between reflected light and projected light.
That's true.
Yeah. Before we end, Joe, I would like to just ask you if you'd like to input any other information that you think might be important for our visitors to know.
Absolutely. There's one last piece of this puzzle that often gets overlooked, and that's how you're judging your prints, meaning what kind of light source are you looking at. When you're working in Photoshop, and if you're doing a soft proof, Photoshop is assuming, and it's soft proof, that you were looking at your images under daylight. That is how it's presenting it on the screen. If you're working in an office that has fluorescent light tubes, they have a very strong green spike to it, so typically what's going to happen is your reds are going to go dull under green light. Again, your eyes adapt to this, but the paper does not. I highly recommend that if you're going to do your own printing and editing, that you invest in some sort of daylight light source, be it continuous spectrum daylight fluorescent tubes or one of the many manufacturers who make daylight viewing booths or lamps so that you can really accurately judge that your print is matching your screen.
Okay, is there no simple light bulb that we could just screw in? We really do need to spend a couple of extra bucks?
They're not all that expensive. There are light fixtures. There are a couple of companies that make daylight viewing lamps that are in the $100 range. X-Rite makes viewing booths for people that are very serious about it that are about $1,400. But you can go to the local hardware store and buy yourself at least some daylight fluorescent tubes, which will get you part of the way there.
Okay, because again, at the end of the day, as most photographers already know, light changes, the color of light changes, even though our eyes just naturally adapt so quickly, effortlessly, and unconsciously, we do know that, you know, in the morning the light is bluer versus late afternoon where the light is warmer. In similar concept, different light sources, be they light bulbs, candles, etc., they're all going to produce a different color temperature. And in order for to get the most consistent results, we're spending so much time, right? We're doing all this calibration. At the end of the day, we want to proof it with our eyes in the same type of light as our monitor is showing it to us. Is that a fair summary?
That's fair. Our monitors are going to be working in daylight, typically 6500K. And if you look at it, a tungsten light, which is 3,000, since our prints are relying on the ambient light to show us their color, they're going to be greatly affected by the color temperature of the light being shown on them. So you really should invest, and it's not a large investment, but you really should invest in some daylight tubes so that what you're seeing on your print is going to match as closely as possible how your monitor describes the colors.
Excellent. Such amazing information. Thank you so much. And it's so apropos because I am going to be reviewing two of Mac Group's higher-end systems the very next podcast. So this is an excellent introduction into the color space and why we need these devices to begin with. So thank you so much for this, Joe. And we'll likely get some more input from you as well once I actually put up the reviews. But thanks so much for your time, Joe. Muchly appreciated.
It's been my pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
Thanks again to Joe Brady for helping demystify some of those terms and for providing us with this incredible introduction into profiling color. Joe's also been nice enough to point me to a couple of links. I believe it's off the Color Monkey site. Link to go in the show notes. But there's also video presentations there that, again, further explain all about color and profiling color and how to get accurate color. We may yet get the benefit of more of Joe's advice next podcast when I review those two systems, the Color Monkey system and the i1 system in depth, and I'll share my results with you. I can tell you straight off the bat that I did my own really quick test whereby I profiled my medium end, very medium end monitor against a much higher end ISO monitor. And the results are quite, quite drastic, unfortunately, because that second monitor is about $1,500. But it's awesome. And I got to tell you, $1,500 is expensive. For sure, it's expensive. But just a few years back, people were talking about higher end monitors that cost in the vicinity of like $2,500 and $3,000. So it's a bit pricey, but if you really want to get accurate color, you may want to consider changing monitors. Oof, hate to say it, but I think that's where I'm going to be investing some of my own future coin in the very, very near future. If you like this podcast and you want to keep getting it automatically, you can just go to the blog on photography.ca, www.photography.ca/blog, and just click the subscribe buttons in any of the ways you can subscribe. And then when these suckers come out, you get them automatically. We have a few thousand people listening already, and kind of keeps growing slowly but surely. So if you like it, you want to tell two friends, it's all appreciated. If you wanted to review it in iTunes, it's all appreciated. You could just search for my name, Marko Kulik, M-A-R-K-O-K-U-L-I-K, and you can find this podcast easily. Or just do a search for photography.ca, and you can find it that way too. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I hope to release the next podcast pretty soon so we could put this information to good measure. As always, just get out there. It's much warmer now. Get out there and shoot weird angles and slap on a wide-angle lens and only shoot wide-angle for a day. Put on a zoom and only use one focal length on that zoom. Move your zoom during the exposure, but get out there and play and just keep on shooting. Bye for now, everyone.